True crime reporter goes inside the Yellow crime scene tape. I'm investigative reporter Robert Riggs with decorated former federal prosecutor Bill Johnston. You can follow our journey into darkness and get bonus episodes by joining our true crime community at truecrimereporter.com. Our true crime cases are stranger than fiction. With that said, here's a classic police procedural, a true crime reporter confidential. Be advised that this podcast is for a mature audience. Some episodes may contain profanity and graphic descriptions of violent crimes. We're talking with David Grantham, a former Air Force counterintelligence officer in Afghanistan and Iraq, who now is head of intelligence for the Tarrant County Sheriff in Fort Worth. And you bring a unique skill set to this, having worked in the most difficult areas, certainly trying to recruit sources. How are you applying that to crime fighting here in Texas? And how should it be applied nationwide?
I really think we have, in law enforcement, so the beauty of being with Air Force Office of Special Investigation, which a lot of people don't really know the organization, we are credentialed federal agents. 1811 is the federal, which Bill would know, the federal code, just like the DEA, FBI, 1811s. So we investigate federal criminal activity within the military. Within that, we also have counterintelligence agents. We're still special agents, but I worked on the counterintelligence side. So I had the beauty of, or the luxury, if you will, the good, great experience in working in law enforcement and intelligence, so I could bridge the gap. So when I came over to the sheriff's office, I looked at the use of our jurisdiction and what we have authority over. And what does the sheriff of every county have authority over? The jail. With that being the case, and me coming from a human background, human intelligence, I decided we need to focus almost all of our effort on talking to people and gathering information inside the jail. And obviously, having been at Camp Buka, I was not unfamiliar with doing that, but just in a very different environment. And what I learned really quickly is that HUMIT is highly undervalued. HUMIT in the long-term sense is undervalued. And what I've tried to bring to the table is not informants that provide momentary glimpses into an organization in order to support or get them out of a current predicament, whether it be a case or whatnot, but developing long-term relationships with people so that it becomes a point where they supply information. I've had people contact me and say, you just treated me so well that I'm willing to just, you treated me like a man, and I'm going to supply you some information for no other reason than that. And that's the one, there's many different things, but that's the one overarching thing, is really getting back to developing relationships with people as a as an intelligence officer, using that in law enforcement.
That is just the right spot, I believe. One of my prosecutors, a guy named Jake Snyder, who was a famous federal prosecutor that worked with me and for me from time to time, said, among other things, we have all the criminals in the world. What we need are witnesses. And in the intelligence world, even more so, you know, I worked in Mexico for a little while on an organization for the U.S. Justice Department, on an organization that was smuggling for the Colombians. And everybody knows that goes on, and everybody, you know, it's not a question that the crimes are taking place, but how are they doing it? Who do they need in this process? And in my case in particular, we got honest Mexican federal judicial police officers to talk to us about corrupt Mexican federal police officers, and it gave them methodology. And once we knew, it's kind of like having a book, but only having the cover. We need to read it, like your book. We need to read it. And that's because if you know really how they do it, who they need, when they do it, in this instance, they had were flying these loads up from the Colombian airstrips near the processing labs for coca and for cocaine there, and landing on dry lake beds, landing at airports in northern Mexico, and being offloaded by Mexican federal police crews. They, you know, Mexico has a tremendous problem with corruption, but we got such insight into it that it led to it being shut down for a period of time. Now, it obviously picks back up, but at least it gave you the intelligence. I mean that sort of figuratively and as a term of art, to know how it's being done. And I think you're right on point. It's the human intelligence. And you can, because of your experience, you can filter out the BS pretty quickly, I'm sure, and also the self-serving stuff. Sometimes self-serving stuff is helpful, but sometimes it's not. But anyway, I think you're right on point there. That's incredible. They're lucky to have you.
And what trends are you seeing? You seeing new crime trends that's going on that's going to threaten, you know, the safety of neighborhoods and businesses?
The crime trends we're seeing, the violent crime is going up everywhere. And when you look at violent crime, you typically assume, well, there's a lot of assumptions that go into that. What we have found with violent crime is you don't necessarily have more criminals on the streets. What you have is people that have been engaged in criminal activity and criminal behavior for some time that now have access to money through unemployment, through stimulus, and they have no job. So they have more money than they've had ever before. Meanwhile, they're the guns that they could never afford before, they can now afford. The drugs they could never afford before, in terms of buying some to resell, they can. So what we have seen is there's quite a bit of violent crime among young people who their first offense is capital murder. Their first offense. Now, this isn't, you know, across the board, but more of that is coming up now than ever before in our history.
How much of that would be stranger on stranger? Or is it just inside the criminal organization?
Right now, it's primarily inside criminal organizations, gangs, cartels, those in between that are just middleman selling. Because you can think of a scenario. We've had several cases that mirror this scenario. You have three individuals who get together for a drug deal. One of them decides that they are getting ripped off and they pull their gun. 10 years ago, those three may have not even met because none of them would have had access to the drugs in order to resell them. It wouldn't have been worth their time. Or they worked for someone who said, you will go sell this drug, and if you screw up, I will kill you. Now they can almost freelance and they get together and one decides I'm being ripped off. Well, now all three of them have guns. 10 years ago, all three of them, maybe one of them would have had a gun. So when you have that scenario, you can only imagine now multiply that by 10, 12, 15, and you have these little situations that are popping up. We're having shootouts among gangs and stuff. There will be, it will happen to strangers. This can't continue to be in these closed society of criminal groups. This will leak out and someone's going to, something tragic's going to happen.
To me, as far as the cartels and most of the, unfortunately, most of the methamphetamine, the cocaine, black tar heroin, most of the marijuana that, and fentanyl that makes its way around is now ultimately controlled by the cartels or shipped by the cartels or held or stashed by the cartels. I'm worried that until Mexico, maybe I shouldn't say until, unless Mexico gets control over that to some degree, it's going to be very hard for us to ever, tamp it down to the point where it's manageable because there's such a supply of cartel members that come across and there's the subdelegates here that operate on their behalf. Do you think that through individuals such as you, officers and deputies and agents that work on cartels, if we got an aggressive effort by prosecutors to, which many many do, to go after them. Can we, do you think, get it under control, or are we dependent upon Mexico? What do you think?
That's a great question. I think rather than it being a one point of failure, it seems to me there needs to be a multi-pronged approach, which I really do hate suggesting that within government, because everything in government seems to be, you know, we have to boil the ocean to solve this issue. And and that's not, that really isn't the case. That shouldn't always be the answer. But in this case, I do think there needs to be operations in tandem, one of them being prosecutors taking on these cases, especially the violent crime and gun cases. The more that we can work with, like we worked with ATF to find situations where we can take people, a violent felon who had a gun, and move them to federal custody because they get hammered on the federal side. Criminals don't want to go federal. Never, ever, ever. They want to stay on the state or local side. It always benefits them. And there's a number of reasons for that, which, you know, you would know, obviously, but the federal side time is more harsh. The liberties are tougher, et cetera. So they don't want to go federal. So I think that's part of it. The other part is a federal government diplomacy with Mexico. The Remain in Mexico policy has been the Supreme Court has said it needs to be reinstated. That was helpful for immigration, but separately, the cartels we know were using immigrants as cover to move drugs. So you could actually see drug seizures on the border picked up in areas where there was also a massive migrant movement. So they were using it as cover. So anything that stems immigration prevents the cartel from leveraging that to get their drugs across. So I think that the third thing I would say is local control. Politics is local. And I would encourage your audience, if you're really interested in how can we stop this, really, it's getting in touch with your sheriff, getting in touch with a local police chief, getting in touch with your school board to see what kind of drug trends they're seeing. Local impact matters. DC responds to local. So I think that is really the third and maybe the most important, is getting locally involved, aware and knowledgeable of what's going on, and seeing how you might be able to contribute to the safety of your community. Because if you're not involved locally, you can't expect someone to come along and do it for you.
Robert and I believe that violent crime, I mean, truly serious violent crime, and deadly drugs, you know, fentanyl and the unquestionably deadly drugs, that's probably the most apolitical or non-political thing in the world. In other words, it's not a Democrat or Republican issue at all. No one wants violent crime to come to them or their neighborhood or their family. So you're right. Everyone, no matter what stripes or spots they have in terms of politics, should want prosecutors to go after violent criminals, should want judges to hold them in jail. There's a huge problem now, which actually is a tangent of the great case Robert and I discussed, the Kenneth McDuff serial killer case, where he got out of prison early. But now in Dallas County, Texas, 2 or 3 months ago, there were 25 capital murder defendants out on bond running the streets. There's probably in Dallas-Fort Worth now, I would bet there's 100. They shouldn't be out. I'm sorry. If you're that violent, I know it's an accusation, but a judge has found, or grand jury has found, probable cause. There has been a finding. There has been a finding that you did it. And so at any rate, we're revisiting something that Robert and I talk about often, which is violent criminals being out to lurk and roam and kill.
And so we're seeing a trend in some cities in Texas, but also across the U.S. of DAs letting people out on personal recognizance bonds, which is no money. We've had officers killed at traffic stops in Houston, and they're just recently been let go for, you know, $200 bond with a gun crime. I've been in Austin shooting on the podcast being made into a television show, and I've spent time in homicide there. And, you know, they're on a record homicide rate. It's like they let everybody go there. They even had a murder there, and they caught the guy because he was out for a murder, but he had on a monitoring bracelet. They caught him on the second murder.
Yeah, it's just crazy that some district attorneys, and you, U.S. attorneys are not so much subject to this because the federal rules are different, but within Texas, there's 254 counties. There are probably, I'm guessing, 150 district attorneys. Some have more than one county. And in places, district attorneys who have, who look at crime as a societal, well, almost as a self-help problem, that's fine about certain things. You can disagree about marijuana. You can disagree about theft, even. People think some theft is excusable. No matter how someone feels about that, someone murdering a stranger, there's nothing, there's no excuse for that. I'm sorry. And so we, until we get citizens electing and keeping district attorneys that will hold people in jail who are accused and have been found to have committed by grand jury serious violent crime, we're going to have more of this. And it, you know, we're giving a cookie to someone who just stole a cookie. We're rewarding very violent criminals by letting them right back out within hours of killing someone.
And I think DAs, in some cases, it's not so much that they have a warped sense of the crime. They have a warped sense of detention.
I think you're right.
They have an unfavorable view of putting someone in jail because of the concept, the academic concept of the jail. And it's really disheartening because the jail is, you know, you'll hear things like, well, it, they didn't, they weren't rebuilt. This didn't
rehabilitate them.
Rehabilitate them. They did, and you say, you know, I wasn't sent to time out as a child. I'm not trying to draw a clumsy comparison, but I wasn't sent to time out as a child because I was necessarily for the sole purpose of me being, I was sent there as a time out, as a consequence of my action, regardless of what I did after that.
And some people are so mean or so dangerous, just so, let's just say, so violent that we have to be, and we have the right to be protected from them. We have to have them in steel and concrete so they can't kill me tonight. It's as simple as that.
And we feel like in Texas, we've forgotten the lessons of history from the Kenneth McDuff case, because McDuff was the tip of the iceberg. To relieve prison overcrowding, the system here secretly started releasing 150 inmates a day.
No matter what.
No matter what. And they later, a parole board member admitted they were scraping the bottom of the barrel. And in scraping it, you know, one of the things I reported back then, McDuff was among them, they had released more than 60 former death row inmates whose sentences had been commuted to life in 1972 when the Supreme Court struck down the death penalty. They became eligible for parole, but no one ever imagined you'd let these men out. Oh, and they did, with a consequence on society.
And the jails are overwhelmed right now as well. The downside, one of the issues with detention across the nation is finding people, just like every other. If you look at McDonald's, you look at these different restaurants, everyone's in the last 9 months has probably gone to a restaurant and someone has said, we just can't get waiters. We're sorry, this is off the menu because we don't have the cook to prepare it. The same thing is happening in detention. They're having problems recruiting for some of the same reasons. There's no real incentive when you're being paid, and there's other incentives not to come in. So that's creating a problem too. So as violent crime increases, the inmate population increases, staffing is remaining stagnant. And so sheriffs and DAs, honest ones, are having to make really tough decisions on how do we maintain the safety and security of our people and the jail and the community, knowing that this is ballooning.
We know from history, the history that Robert and I have spent 40 hours or more discussing and taping shows for, the answer is this: pay them more. Pay more, build more jails. As to violent crime, let's just talk about violent crime. Texas decided in the 80s and 90s, let them out. We're not, as the Republican governor at the time said, we're not spending our good tax dollars to build more prisons. Why not? You just had innocent people killed tonight because of your didn't want to spend tax. You want to spend, as a taxpayer, an extra $9 a year in taxes, or do you want to be murdered? And so the answer as to institutions, county jails and so forth, that can't get people is pay them more. Pay them more so you're staffed up. Give them a better incentives to work there. Make the shifts different. Be creative. Come up with a plan so that you can keep people in jail that need to be in jail. Do you need bail reform for nonviolent crime, for regarding marijuana and so forth and petty theft. Sure. And they've done that. Almost all over Texas, they've done that. They don't hold those people anymore. They used to. And people that are indigent, people that can't afford to make bond, but it's a nonviolent crime, they fixed that already.
And Tarrant County has stepped up to the plate and raised, I think now we have the highest paid starting salary for detention
there
officers. They responded immediately to that, which should be an encouragement to the people of Tarrant County.
Yes.
Well, one of the things we saw in back in history is that both parties, Democrat and Republican, talk tough on crime. They passed around 100 laws aimed at different drug offenses. Crack cocaine was a big problem, but refused to build any new prisons. And you just literally had blood in the streets from all of these violent criminals released that were a consequence. And the public didn't know it. They had no idea this was going on until it really came out with the McDuff case and others.
Yeah, I think there's a warped sense of what detention, as you mentioned, Bill, what detention is intended for. And until we can move past that, you're going to constantly have DAs that and others that see the jail as some sort of inappropriate use of tax dollars. And that's going to be a struggle. And that's where I go back to that third point, local control. You in the county, citizens in that area, they vote in that district attorney, and you can vote out that district attorney, and you don't need outside forces to influence that. You don't need to go to DC to do that.
Let's talk about the border a minute. We've seen with the change in policy, there is a flood of immigrants coming across, and it's all controlled by the cartels. They're making a bloody fortune. And one of the things you see is all of these young women coming, and they don't have any skills, and they're indebted to the cartels. Are we going to see a surge in sex trafficking or other kinds of crimes out of all of this? What do you see coming?
I can tell you what we've seen and then what I think's coming.
All
what
right.
We have seen is cartel moving in people. When COVID hit, the border was shut down. It was very difficult to move. The price of methamphetamine. So meth is king in North Texas. And there's a number of reasons for that. Partially, it has to do with it has a shelf life. Cocaine, powdered cocaine, could sit in a closet as long as it stayed dry and out of humidity. It can be sold and used 30 years later. Methamphetamine has a shelf life. So when it gets North Texas, it's dispersed pretty quickly. And when the border was shut down, the price of a gram of meth went from $20 to $80. $20 for a gram of meth is dirt cheap, but that's because there's so much of it. When the border opened up, a lot of cartel who were waiting to come over to manage some of the drug distribution, they came with these drugs. So what we're seeing is more and more reinforcements coming in to help leverage the drug distribution network. So we're seeing an increased presence of decision makers here locally, meaning I don't have to call back to Mexico.
They're in a position to run human trafficking.
Absolutely. But what they tend to do is they will outsource that to criminal gangs who use human trafficking as their source of revenue. And the cartel, they understand that's a hot, delicate issue. They're going to get involved if it makes money, but that's going to bring a lot of heat, as they say in the law enforcement world, a lot of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. So these criminal gangs who are less sophisticated, if you will, but willing to get involved, they are going to be more intent on human trafficking. And human trafficking is more lucrative than drugs, because once drugs has been used, they're done. A female can be used 12, 15 times a day, and she can be trafficked all over the country. So that's what makes human trafficking so difficult to counteract is the fact that the supply can be moved around, and if you don't know who that supply is, it can be very difficult to stop. Moreover, many of them are addicted to drugs, or they're put in a situation where they don't know they can leave. They've effectively been brainwashed. Our human trafficking unit and those units that work around North Texas, they'll tell you, it may take 7 or 8 times an outcry. A victim will make an outcry 7 or 8 times before they'll even consider sharing information about the people that are running them. It takes that many engagements to get them out and feel safe to communicate. So that's a very long answer mm-hmm. to your question, mm-hmm. but I think it's one of those that are going to go in tandem. If the drug networks continue to thrive, we're seeing fentanyl used to be in a couple places. Now fentanyl's everywhere.
It's international.
They're word cutting, where you insert it in other drugs. They're cutting other drugs with fentanyl. So heroin, methamphetamine.
Why are they doing that? Because it seems like it would make, you don't want to kill your customers. I was in Brazil years ago and I was talking to a state police officer in Sao Paulo, and he said, well, our gangs down there quit selling crack. You know, when crack was first popular, and cocaine's everywhere in Brazil, or can be obtained everywhere. They said, well, they found out they were killing too many of their customers and making them too crazy. So we don't do crack down here. We just do powdered cocaine. But it seems like the fentanyl would kill the customer. No?
Yes. ODs were those fentanyl involved ODs have gone up significantly in the last 2 years. But I don't know that
better high.
Yes. That's part of it. The user knows there's a better high coming. That's part of it. But I don't think there's much concern for killing the user. The cart, and that's where you begin cutting it with other drugs. That way the high gets better. They'll come back to you exclusively. And if a competitor is using fentanyl inappropriately, they'll kill their users. I won't kill mine, and therefore I can make more money.
And there's almost no science. There's certainly no specificity to how they cut it. You know,
we like to say there's no quality control.
No quality control. Yeah, it might be that you're getting 10% methamphetamine and 1% fentanyl in one dose, and the next one is 30% of each, and you're dead.
Yes.
So, wow.
Well, if you ever see the people out there dealing, and the, you know, they don't cut this stuff in FDA-approved labs.
Right.
You know?
No.
Do you see the reach of the Mexican cartels? Because we've seen reports how they're in other countries around the world. They become an international criminal organization. Australia, Europe. Do you pick that up in your intelligence?
Their reach is incredible. Their sophistication is it's really unmatched in criminal circles. And we see a reach among the Sinaloa cartel, specifically the Jalisco cartel, who are former Sinaloa members. Mm-hmm. And they have burst on the scene. Well, they burst on the scene, 5, 6 years ago, really became juggernauts, if you will. And they were tapping into the Sinaloa cartel routes. They were using their logistic networks. They had control of this, so they understood how to use it. So when we talk about reach, you really have to consider the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco New Generation cartel are the two that are have enormous and professional operations. And Jalisco cartel have a presence in Texas that the Sinaloa cartel never had.
I just glimpsed an analogy, which may not be fair to Mexico, but it may be too. In Afghanistan, you have a government. It's a corrupt, it's going to be a corrupt, twisted government, but it will be a government of some sort run by the Taliban for some period of time. And within that, all kinds of terrible things happen there and will be exported. In Mexico, whose government has struggled with corruption since the revolution, the cartels, either out of corruption or fear, are allowed by the government. By that I mean fear or corruption by the government. Fear that they'll kill us all. They'll kill the leaders. They'll kill the president. It's nothing for them to do that. Or through corruption. I worked a case many years ago. We could never get it off the ground, but where the Colombians, this is when the cartels weren't doing all the transshipping, where the Colombians decided to try to bribe the entire Mexican cabinet. They were sick of piecemealing it. But that's the level that it can reach there. So in Mexico, you have a government that, for fear or because of corruption, is allowing the cartel to run amok. to control whole areas, to slaughter people and hang them from bridges in Veracruz and Tampico and elsewhere. I'm not sure that's a lot different than, in terms of this, exporting drugs and terror, murder is terror, to the United States. I wish we considered it more important.
Absolutely. I've talked to people over and over again who see the Taliban and see what goes on in the Middle East as some sort of, as a dynamic that's exclusive to the Middle East. And they see the violence and, beheadings to be specific, and are traumatized. Like, how do people live like that? And I said, if you look over the border, this kind of stuff happens. At one point, one of the Mexican border cities was one of the most violent in the country. So you don't have to look too far to that. And it is, when you really look at the facts, it is quite startling to see the level of violence and the level of brutality that we don't have to travel to Afghanistan to see.
The cartels are so rich now. My concern as an investigative reporter is their reach into American politicians, county government, city government, mayors, district attorneys, of literally buying people off. And we've seen cases here in Dallas, Texas, where it doesn't take much to buy people off. And I've done those stories and all. So any signs of that, concerns?
That's one of my primary concerns. So I go back to encouraging local control by citizens. If you're thinking that way, so are they. When you look at, let's go big, the Chinese government, and that situation with Eric Swalwell, congressman out of California, he was given a defensive debriefing by the FBI, which essentially says, hey, you're not doing anything wrong, but you need to know who's around you. Well, what got lost in all that is there was two mayors that were also involved with this female spy. And the question I kept raising was, why are we not talking about that? Why would the Chinese go after local mayors? Like, what would benefit them? And I mean, I have my own theories, and I think are correct in most situations, in that you go after the low-hanging fruit because, frankly, that's the most bang for your buck. It takes less money, and I get more access to strategic things that are in those areas, just like hacking. I don't want to hack the U.S. government. I can hack a local institution and get some of the same material I need, hack a subcontractor versus the major contractor. The cartels are also thinking like this. More money is, or it's more effective and less money if you can pay off
a state judge in some small county on the border.
Correct. And now you have control and you have a corridor there. Why would I bribe a federal official? That's going to get me more time. That's going to become problematic for my organization. But if I bribe local officials all the way up, and if I'm in an area where that official has so much clout that no one's willing to push back on them, I'm good to go.
Right.
Well, and if you destroy integrity in a republic, that's the downfall of it. We're going to pause for a moment. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Robert Riggs here with my co-host Bill Johnston, and we're back for part two of our interview with David Grantham. David is a former Air Force Special Operations Intelligence Officer and doing counterintelligence in Afghanistan and Iraq. This is his book, Consequences of an Intelligence Officer's War, a great look at boots on the ground of what it took to try to get sources to reveal terrorist plans around U.S. bases and to protect U.S. soldiers. David is now with the Tarrant County Sheriff's Department based out of Fort Worth, where he heads up intelligence. And we're going to talk about game rooms and start by telling us, what is a game room? Because there is a proliferation of them across Texas and other states.
A game room is essentially a location. It can be an existing business or just a standalone shed or vacant building where someone has put in gambling machines. And those gambling machines, as the name implies, they're used, for gambling. And people will come in there and gamble on these machines, but it's done in a way that under Texas law, it's illegal to cash out winnings. So if I gamble and you cannot cash me out with money, so what they'll do is they'll design this game room and they'll put prizes on the wall to give the suggestion that anybody coming in law enforcement wise will see that and assume that there is no money being paid out. It's just merely prizes. And these rooms can have 30 to 40 games in them. And some organizations and some businesses now with new ordinances in place in Tarrant County specifically, they know you can have at least 5 games and they'll have stickers that show approval. But yet they're not using them for legal gambling purposes or legal purposes. They're using them to gamble. That is the structure of a game room.
And it's not so much what we're talking about these and having handled some of these cases. It's not, we're not here to discuss the morals of gambling. Someone could drive an hour and a half north to the Red River and from where we are seated and go into Oklahoma and do the same thing in a legitimate, but it's what, because this is illicit and against the law in Texas and so forth, it's what happens with all of this money generated from it, right? And the illegality and the scurrilous conduct that takes place in connection with that. Tell us a little bit about what looks like is happening with this tens and hundreds and millions of dollars that come out of these rooms.
So one, if you we've seen game rooms where there'll be 30 gambling, 30 machines, and those machines in one night, each one could profit the owner $1,000. So if you have 30 machines, you can begin doing the math, and that's just one day. You multiply that per week, 30,000 per day per week. Multiply that by most people have more than one game room. They have 3 or 4 of these game rooms. The profits are enormous. And those profits are, they're obviously not taxed, but they also are flowing to places that we're not quite clear where it's going. It's not, there are a lot of operators who are likely using money to fuel other criminal activity overseas. We see a lot of non-U.S. citizens or non-U.S. born operating these multiple game families will operate these game rooms, and they're not using their profits locally, or at least their lifestyle doesn't suggest that. They'll have a modest house. They'll have cars that are, it's not like the old time drug dealer where you see them driving fancy cars and beautiful homes, and they have, you know, no record of any kind of employment.
Some of this money's possibly going to the Middle East. Some of it's going in Central and South America.
Correct. It's traveling in places that we know specifically. It'll go to places in Jordan, in Pakistan, India, and we don't know what those profits are being used for.
But they're sure not paying taxes like we all have to pay taxes on our income, which is one of the fundamental things that's unfair about it. Some person that has to pay taxes on their income goes in and loses $1,000, and that person takes it gleefully and doesn't even pay tax for the most part.
And one of the biggest problems with the game room, outside of the money laundering and where it's likely being used to fuel criminal activity, possibly terrorism in other places, it also fuels violent crime locally. So what we
game room ripoffs, right? Game robberies.
Robberies. But what you can think of a scenario where you have someone who's a drug user. They want their drugs. They don't have the money to get it. They go in and gamble what little money they have. They may profit. Then they go buy this these drugs. Well, as that person is leaving with that money, there's a stick up man there who knows I need that money so I can go get my drugs. So you create an environment where crime is happening in order to do that. Moreover, since these operators generally operate their establishments illegally and they know there's illegal activity,
it's not regulated.
They don't mind other illegal activity going yes. on there. So what they'll do is they'll allow for drug dealers to come in and sell their drugs because they know if you're on meth, and mind you, meth keeps you up for 2-3 days at a time. If you're on meth, you'll stay and gamble longer. And they will encourage this type of sale to go on. They won't endorse it or do it themselves, but they will allow for that. So I've talked to, I don't know how many drug dealers that said, if I have ever have a problem offloading any drugs, I go straight to a game room and I get rid of it immediately.
I was telling you in my experience, not just prosecutors, but I've had judges tell me, you know, this looks like penny ante, you know, gambling here, little slot machine in the back of a gas station. I don't want that in my court. You've run across this, haven't you?
Absolutely. When it comes to intelligence, if you could visualize two triangles that their points meet in the middle. For law enforcement, for prosecutors, it generally starts at this end and gets smaller. You have a crime that's committed, it's investigated, and then prosecuted the tip. Intelligence works the opposite direction. It starts at the tip where a need. There is a need, we collect intelligence about that need, and then we analyze that information in a larger scope, which is then can turn into something. What ends up happening is we collect this information on game rooms, we show it, but when it comes to the prosecution, it becomes difficult because they're not the ones selling drugs, or we need 2 to 3 years to investigate the money laundering side of it. So that becomes problematic because there's only so much runway that you're given on a local level. So what ends up happening is, what is the immediate crime we can look at right now? Gambling, organized crime. That's usually a good one. But again, when the underlying offense is gambling, it becomes less of an incentive for prosecutors to pursue. Never mind that it is the source of violent crime. So what we have looked at is some of those OCDEF or larger federal organized crime cases that maybe we could rope in. When we can prove there's an organization, we can say there's money laundering inside this organization. They're fencing stolen equipment, stolen goods here. They're allowing the sale of drugs. And by virtue of that, they're profiting from those drug sales. That's really the approach you have to take, but you have to get a lot of people on board to appreciate how problematic game rooms themselves are for a local community.
Legitimate gambling in a jurisdiction that knows how to regulate it. Often I've been told some of the safest places around a casino in Las Vegas, for instance, you have law enforcement off duty or former law enforcement doing security. You have cameras everywhere. You have regulation of the profits. You have immediate tax reporting requirements, and you have tremendous security. It's so rare. It happens very, very rarely that a casino is robbed or there's violent crime around a casino. You have just the flip side underbelly here. You have completely unregulated gambling, which yields all of the dark fungus that comes with it. But it is hard to get people interested, Robert.
You know, I had an experience where there was a group robbing storage units. I mean, on a big scale, leaving with TVs, furniture, clothes, washing machines. And the detectives told me that it all gets fenced at game rooms. I mean, it seems like the game room is kind of the nexus of criminal activity.
That's a great way to put it. It is, and it's a nexus of criminal activity. And yet, when you try to get that in front of a prosecutor, they look for the criminal activity that's being, so they would look at, well, who is fencing? To them, it's almost, sometimes the game room is, could just as well be a random gas station or a parking lot in McDonald's where they're fencing equipment. And that becomes the challenge.
They don't realize it's a magnet.
It is. And if there was a, and many prosecutors in good faith will go down this path with you. Many judges in good faith will try to find a way to get there. But it becomes very difficult that you can't prosecute for being a magnet for crime.
But you know, I have been in these places, and you'll find grandma in there as well.
Yes. And that's the other, you have to educate your local community on what the game room is, because the some of these, again, these people that are elected or appointed by elected officials, they're responding to or responsive to a community. And if the community is not does not see the game room as a threat or as a problem, because in their mind, it's someone who is just gambling away maybe their retirement money of their doing, their choosing. You have to educate on that there's it's a magnet for criminal activity, and something that happened at your local gas station very well could have started at a game room.
Wow.
Are you also looking at, this is all from the game rooms, but do you look at the computer crimes, the, you know, extortion and stuff people are doing these days?
Yes, we track cyber criminal activity and cyber trends. It's becoming more and more difficult for local institutions because much like the cartel and even adversaries like China are recruiting on a local level, elected officials or just attempting to access things on a local level because it's easier, they also will hack local institutions. It's much easier to hack a local police department and get information, or the big problem right now is ransomware.
Yes.
That's becoming the most problematic because for under the same idea, criminal organizations know, why would I hack Department of Homeland Security when I can hack, let's name a city and a police department, hack them, freeze their information? There was cases in Florida that had to be thrown out or adjudicated because they lost the records were destroyed, the electronic records. They know that now, or in DC, they had accessed source information. And that becomes incredibly dangerous when you have criminal organizations that access that information and then hold it for ransom. You're making a very difficult decision. Do we pay this ransom to get our source information back and our criminal files for prosecution?
But just like the 10, 20 years ago, the common, often phone and internet scam, they were predominantly out of Nigeria. And they were promises that someone had inherited money but needed a bank account to run it through. So if you had just given them your bank account information and $10,000, they'll give you $100,000 next week because King, whoever, has just given them money. Then there were thousands of these everywhere. The problem being they originated in Nigeria. There is no way in the world you're going to get a criminal out of Nigeria. It's not even worth indicting someone. And similarly, the Russian-based, Ukrainian-based, Chinese-based, pick a place, Brazilian-based, South Korea-based scams, it's a perfect crime almost because the reach is so far that other than a few efforts the Justice Department has made, the U.S. Justice Department has made, it's almost impossible to get accountability. So almost you spend most of your time with warning people about it.
Yep. You begin putting your whole shtick is putting together products as warnings versus trying to enforce. The other thing that we encounter is there's a fairly significant gap in the federal threshold, the amount of money that has to be quarantined, if you will, to use that word in a, in a different sense. There's a threshold there that has to be met. On the local level, that threshold isn't there, but there's a significant gap that on the local level, there aren't really the resources to respond to a massive amount that could be just below the threshold of the federal government's willing to prosecute. So you have this wide gap when it comes to these ransomwares, and that creates even more incentive, and criminals begin to know, stay under this number, but above this number, and there's a good chance they're just going to pay the ransom.
It's like the convenience kidnappings, that's what I call them, in Brazil and Mexico and other places in Central and South America. If they kidnap an American tourist and just want $10,000, they'll probably get it. If they want $1 million, no, they won't. So what do they do then? But these convenience kidnappings committed in Mexico and Central and South America by police officers, frankly, and others, they know. Just set the bar low and you'll get paid, likely, and someone will wire money and go to your next case. It's clever. It's sadly clever.
When you talk about wiring money, though, the ransomware thieves, they all want it in cryptocurrency.
Correct. And we just saw, about a month ago, the FBI was able to recover some of the Bitcoin that was taken from ransomware investigation. And I think that is going to be an important avenue is finding that transfer and just inserting themselves to stop the transfer or to recover some of that.
Does the complexity of this, though, just exceed the capabilities of local departments?
It's if it hasn't gotten there already, then it will reach. The local departments are doing their best in many cases to try to advance their cyber understanding and their protection. But, local governments are what I like to say are often 10 years behind the trend.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing is the defensive nature of cyber operations at a local institution are catching up, but we're kind of past the you need to, bone up on your defensive measures. We're really at a point where you need to be able to investigate and prosecute. You need to do everything from screen grab messages to store this information to have an IP ad. You have to have all these things in order to deliver to a prosecutor who is then willing to take the case. Right now we're in a defensive nature.
Yes.
I'm a member of the FBI's InfraGuard unit here, which was set up to protect infrastructure after 9/11. And I was in a briefing about all the threats and what's happening in cyber. And I turned to the agent next to me and said, I think we're all a lot better off when we just put it all on paper in file cabinets and lock the file cabinet.
Yeah, it is. You almost get to the point where it becomes so hard to fathom. There was a department store somewhere that was hacked, and they said they got 30 million customer records. And I went, whatever. If you're willing to sift through 30 million records of customers, if you got mine, great. We're having to really balance risk versus reward. And because things have become so digital, now we used to say in the intelligence community with different adversaries like China, they will collect everything, take it back, and then sift through it. Russia was specific. They wanted this, and they would work hard at attacking that and getting it. So what we thought was, let's just send them junk. When they hack something, and we know they will, let's just have a whole truckload of useless paperwork that at least will bog them down their analytical process.
Send them War and Peace something, 1,000 times.
Exactly, yeah. And let them sift through it.
David Grantham, thank you for joining us. This concludes part 2 of our interview with you. And once again, the book is Consequences, an Intelligence Officer's War, the boots on the ground look at what it was like to try to gather intelligence to protect U.S. Soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thank you again for joining us, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
We want to be your favorite true crime podcast, so please recommend us to your friends and leave a review wherever you listen. If you want to receive updates and bonus interviews, join our true crime community at truecrimereporter.com. If you have suggestions or know of a case that we should look into, email us at fan@truecrimereporter.com. This podcast is a trademarked and copyrighted news organization based in Dallas, Texas. You can read more about our news team at truecrimereporter.com. Thanks for listening to our Journey into Darkness.